This is the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Lots going on in terms of the nation, especially on the political scene. Just take the last 72 hours or so and just think about how everything seems to be changing as there is the narrowing of the nomination process, as there is now an acceleration, especially as about half the country is going to have an opportunity to vote in the primary series known as Super Tuesday. Coming in less than a week now. And with that in light of contemporary developments, there's just a lot going on. Last night at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, California, there was the latest of the Republican debates. Tonight, the latest of the Democratic debates. And once again, the stakes just get higher and higher as you get further and further into the process. And so there's a lot going on, all kinds of endorsements going on. And we will not be tracing those. You can get that from the national media. But it's fair to say right now that people are beginning to enter the commitment phase of the political process. And if you are, for instance, a Democratic office holder, you're probably going to have to decide between some kind of endorsement or at least a tip of the hat towards the Clinton or the Obama candidacies. On the Republican side, something very similar going on. A lot of Christians are looking at this, and most of us are not being asked for endorsements. We're just trying to figure out what it is we are to do. We're trying to figure out how, as Christians, we are to come up with a rationale for how to vote. I'm going to introduce today Albert Mohler's patented three-step Christian voting process. A little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I mean it very seriously. I'm going to suggest three criteria to use for a Christian to use in thinking about how to vote. Three C's: competence, character, and convictions. And I want us to have a conversation about how we actually make the decision of making a choice between two electoral, or for that matter, more than two, multiple electoral candidates. How do we decide? I'm going to suggest that perhaps we can talk about a reasonable setup, understanding, formula, structure for this thinking, and with those three words, competence, character, and convictions. Number one, looking at whether the person is actually up to the job, has the experience, the qualifications requisite for this kind of responsibility. Secondly, what is the individual's character? Is this a person I would trust in this office? Does this person have the maturity, the integrity, the character in order to fulfill this office and its responsibilities, to symbolically hold this office and represent us? And third, convictions. Let's look at the actual policy positions. Let's figure out whether this individual actually has anything in terms of a comprehensive and systematic understanding, a consistent understanding. When we look at the policies, do they line up with what we are looking for? And just for fun, I'm calling it the Albert Mohler three-step patented Christian voting formula. It's open for your discussion today. The conversation is yours by calling 2-877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll be back for the discussion about how we make decisions in voting in just a moment. First, to review some of the issues in the news, I wrote an article about 2 weeks ago entitled "A New Voice is Heard in the Abortion Debate," and it has to do with a report out of the Los Angeles Times dated early in January about a meeting of men who were getting together to talk about the fact that they were the missing voice in abortion. They were the men who were the fathers of babies who were aborted. They were talking about their loss. They were talking about a male, that is, a father version of post-abortion syndrome. They were talking about their guilt. They were talking about their shame. They were talking about their loss. Let me just remind you the kind of loss they were talking about. Here is a citation from the Los Angeles Times article I wrote about and we talked about 2 weeks ago. Jason Bayer talks often to the little boy he calls Jamie. He imagines this boy, his son, with blonde hair and green eyes, chubby cheeks, a sweet smile. But he'll never know for sure. His fiancée's sister told him about the abortion after it was over. Bear remembers that he cried. The next weeks and months go black. He knows he drank far too much. He and his fiancée fought until they broke up. "I hated the world," he said. Bear, age 36, still longs for the child who might have been, with an intensity that bewilders him. "How can I miss something I never even held?" End quote. Well, there's a rather eloquent testimony from a man who says, look, there's more to abortion than what just the media and others want to focus on. There's more to it even than the woman, more to it even than just the baby. Now, the pro-life movement has appropriately focused upon the unborn child as the primary moral concern. But as the emphasis upon post-abortion syndrome for women, which, by the way, made its way into the partial birth abortion ban decision handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court, and now also for men, this becomes very meaningful. Now, I wrote about this as a new voice in the abortion debate. Well, it's a voice others don't want. The cover story in The Nation. The Nation is the flagship masthead of the far left in this country. If you're looking for what remains of the far, far, hard left, you're going to find it in The Nation. The Nation's cover story is entitled The Mourning, M-O-U-R-I-N-G, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, after, The Mourning After, and it has to do with this report out of the Los Angeles Times, the same article that prompted my article. Sarah Bluestein, writing for The Nation, takes her measure of the new movement. Now, listen, this is what she writes. Her article's entitled Pity the Man. Now, remember, this is going to be the hard left. This is going to be hard abortion rights. This is going to be hard feminism. Well, just brace yourselves. This is what she writes in her article. Pity the man who conceived four babies with four women and suffered anxiety attacks and nightmares after all four, with his consent, were aborted. Pity the man who saw his soon-to-be-born baby on an ultrasound and instantly came to believe that he had killed two of my own kids, that's in quotation marks, through abortion. Pity the man who abused alcohol after his girlfriend aborted. Pity the man who suffered a nervous breakdown, depression, psychosis, and nearly suicide after his girlfriend had an abortion despite his pleas. And pity these men who, unwittingly or not, are allowing their pain to be co-opted for political gain. Whatever the cause of their suffering, it is real and they deserve support. But they are also the new face of the anti-abortion movement, post-abortion syndrome for men. In conferences and counseling, they're being wrapped in the fuzzy blankets of men's healing. But behind these men and their stories are the same crackpot research, coercive counseling, and policy by anecdote that have defined the anti-abortion movement's tactical emphasis on women's suffering after abortion. It's a maxim among the anti-choice crowd these days that there are, quote, two victims of abortion, end quote. The men's post-abortion syndrome movement wants to take that to three. Well, actually, more than that, as she reflects in the very end of her article, she writes, suddenly, using nothing but anecdote framed in scientific forms, a single abortion has not one victim or even two, but three or four or five. And beyond that, millions of abortions have millions of victims, one in four women, and by extension, one in four men and one in four parents and countless children until society itself is a victim. Well, as I ended my article published this morning at albertmuller.com, amazingly enough, she gets it. Now, here's what's going on. It really is fascinating because The Nation here, and in this case, the author is Sarah Bluestein, she sees this entire movement as nothing more than a continuation of a movement to deny women the right to abortion. In other words, if your worldview begins with the fact that the great, great thing you must preserve and protect at all costs is what you formulate as a woman's right to abortion, then anything that complicates free access and free momentum toward that goal is to be considered an impediment. Obviously, the fetus is an impediment, so you can't focus on the fetus. You don't want women seeing the ultrasound. You don't want women coming to terms with the fact it is a baby. You want them just focusing on the fact that it's their right, and if it's not the right time to have a baby, if it's an inconvenient time to have a baby, if they just don't want a baby, they can have an abortion. You also don't want people focusing on this post-abortion stress syndrome, on the fact that women who have had abortions are reporting their own depression, their own sense of loss, their own regret. Now, it's interesting, by the way, that they come by and then accuse the pro-life movement of doing research by anecdote. Well, if you know the kind of case that was made for abortion, it's precisely by anecdote. Here was a coat hanger abortion. Here's a woman who died. In other words, that rings pretty false. But now with the men's issue, you can just see why the pro-choice, pro-abortion movement fears this kind of argument so much. This is a new voice, and Sarah Bluestein really does get it when she says, look, here is why the pro-abortion movement has got to fear and resist this kind of language. Because it points out that the victim of abortion, if you're going to talk that way, she doesn't want to, but she has to now, is not just one person, the fetus, nor two, just the fetus and his mother, but it's also the fetus, the mother, the father, and then grandparents, society at large. And as she points out, if one out of every four women have an abortion, then one out of every four women and one out of every four of these fathers, and then going on from there, is a part of this entire complex of the tragedy of abortion. Well, again, she gets it. She doesn't want it. She wants to call it nothing more than politics and an effort to deny women what they call the right to choose. But the bottom line is, she has heard this voice that is a new voice in the abortion debate. And if you're ardently pro-abortion and pro-choice, this is a voice you definitely do not want to hear. We're going to come back to talk about how we as Christians should frame our electoral decision, our voting decision. I'm going to suggest that we need to be thinking in terms of competence and character and convictions. I'd love to know what you're thinking as you are making this decision and perhaps talking to others about how we as Christians should exercise our stewardship of the vote. All that and more coming up on the Albert Mueller Program. To join the discussion, call 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. We'll be right back with your calls.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
All right, let me give you a real-life scenario. You're in the car, you're driving along, and you may be listening to the news on the radio, and issues come up about the primaries and all that's going on, maybe a little focus on Super Tuesday. I was talking to some very young children this morning, and a six-year-old little boy. Now, a very politically active and intelligent six-year-old boy, one of Russ Moore's six-year-old sons, looked up at me and said, "McCain won the primary." Now, when you've got six-year-olds following the primary results, you got some good opportunity for discussion. So you're in the car, and you're in the car with your own six-year-old or 10-year-old or 16-year-old, and your child turns to you and says, "Mom, Dad, how do you decide who to vote for?" There's an election coming up. Maybe some of you have voted. About half of the population is likely to have an opportunity to vote on Tuesday. How do you decide? You've got to explain it now. What do you say? "Well, I know I vote for the candidate that looks like me, that sounds like us. I vote for the candidate that is most eloquent, gives the best speeches." I don't think you're going to say that. I vote for the candidate who is just of this party or that party. Well, an awful lot of Americans make the decision just that way. All you need is party ID. And in many states, you have, you know, straight party voting. You just walk in and just click, click. No real decision needed there. But I think most of us, if asked that question, are going to try to come up with some kind of framework to say, "Well, you know, son, you know, daughter, I've tried to make the decision this way." All right. I want to try to offer a simplified outline for us to think about as we think about how we decide for whom we will vote. I think when you're thinking of candidates, and whether it's for a primary or in a caucus or a general election, or frankly, whether it's for the county tax assessor or the office of president or the United States, I think these three words are absolutely essential. They all begin with C, and we can just remember them as starting with C. Competence, character, and convictions. The first one is competence. In other words, one of the most important things that we would all acknowledge I think we need from someone who will be elected to office is the ability to fulfill the office. And certainly there are a lot of things that would feed into that. And so as we're explaining this, we would simply want to say, look, for instance, no one's going to elect to or should elect to the office of the presidency of the United States someone who has no political experience, someone who has no understanding of our system of government, someone who has no managerial or executive experience, someone who has no experience dealing with the relational responsibilities of foreign relations and all the rest, someone who has very little knowledge of the world. You know, if we're coming up with a competence list for various offices, well, I mean, would you elect someone to be the tax assessor that doesn't know anything about taxation, about property values, or all the rest? Well, I don't think so. Would you elect someone to be, you know, the state insurance commissioner that doesn't know anything about insurance? No, you would want that. You know, you would probably want your attorney general to be an attorney and to be a scholar of the law. There are certain issues of competence there. But, you know, when you look at the candidates, generally, most of the people who make it through the nomination process and actually are on the ballot are likely to be at least basically competent. By the time you start looking at, for instance, the presidential election, and you get to the final stages in which we're entering now, you look at the front runners in both the parties, they're both basically competent. They wouldn't be where they are now if they were not competent. If competence was the only issue, then you'd have a very difficult time, because if you have in front of your name the title senator or governor, you're at least somewhat competent, because you don't get there by falling into the office. And if you make it this far in the nominating process, you've got some level of competence. But then it takes discernment, doesn't it? Okay, who has exactly the right profile of competence? For instance, one of the issues in thinking about the presidency is, since it is an executive office, is the Senate the best way to gain competence for that office, or is a governorship? In recent years, Americans have tended to turn to governors for executive experience because it's understood that they have that kind of background. Ronald Reagan, elected in 1980. Bill Clinton, elected in 1992. George W. Bush, elected in 2000. All of those basically judged as competent because they had served as governor of major states. All right. Competence is the first place to start. Then the second I would suggest is character. Now, this one, in some ways, is a bit more subtle. I mean, how do you define character? I love the old definition by D.L. Moody, the evangelist in the 19th century, who said, character is who you are in the dark. In other words, it's your personal integrity. It's the real you. And certainly, we want persons in office who represent character, who have courage, who will seek to do that which is honorable, who will aim at what is excellent. But, you know, if we merely define character in secular terms, we as Christians know we're missing something. Because we know that character, essentially, is that which aligns us with Christ's likeness. And so we're going to be looking for some other things. Even though we can't judge the heart of a character or of a candidate, we are judging their actions, we're judging the way they present themselves. And so we're going to be looking for such things as a commitment to love and justice and mercy. That's all a part of character. It is, of course, what someone is in the dark. Do you basically trust them? Are they trustworthy? Is there the basic integrity here? Competence, courage, or character is the best word to use there. Competence, character, and convictions. You know, that's where we get to the policies. What does this person believe? What is this candidate's political philosophy? What is this candidate's worldview? What's the candidate's position on the crucial issues of the day? And boy, this is really, really big stuff, because you've got huge dividing lines in this culture. Does this person believe that government is to be large or small? Does he or she believe that the government that governs best governs least, or the one that governs most governs best? Does this person believe that taxation is to be redistributive, basically, or does this person believe that taxation is to be minimal in order to preserve and to fund core services, national defense, roads, and all the rest? What is this person's conviction concerning the legal process, concerning law and order, concerning crime and punishment? What is this person's convictions concerning war and peace, concerning economics, concerning immigration policy? You could go down an entire list. You have to. But you also know that there are other issues. What about the issues of human life and human dignity? Where does this person stand? Pro-abortion or pro-life? A negotiated position they would claim in between. You've got to be able to negotiate all this. Embryonic stem cell research. What kind of person would, if elected president, this person appoint to the United States Supreme Court? These are all conviction questions. And one of the things we have to note is that most human beings in this fallen world are somewhat inconsistent. In other words, you think, well, I can follow issue A, B, C, D, and E, but all of a sudden you get to issue J, the person's a little off the reservation. One of the things we have to remember is that we're not looking for perfection. We're looking for the best choice out of the possible. We're looking to make an informed and responsible Christian decision. We're looking to exercise the stewardship of our vote in a way that would honor God and serve our neighbor as our brother and sister. We're looking to do that which is best in a fallen world. I'd love to know how you're thinking about this. Let's say that your child's asking you, how do you decide for whom to vote? Let's say that there's a new citizen in this country, just naturalized, just took the oath of citizenship. She turns to you and says, how do you decide for whom to vote? How are you going to answer? I'm suggesting, in what I'm lightheartedly calling my patented Christian voting formula, competence, character, and conviction. I'm sure there's something for you to add as well. Call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Give us a call and join the discussion on the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. I'd love to know how you would answer the question. Your child's in the car with you. Ask the question, Mom, Dad, how do you decide for whom to vote? How are you going to answer? And by the way, I think most people trying to answer that question would probably answer it more faithfully than sometimes they actually vote. Because after all, when our child asks us a question, we want to present ourselves that are most thoughtful rather than least thoughtful. I'm afraid an awful lot of people go into the voting booth. As a matter of fact, a lot of studies indicate that a vast number of Americans go in the voting booth not knowing for whom they're going to vote until they get there. That's scary enough. I'd love to know how you would answer the question and how you think we ought to prioritize these issues. I suggested a three-step formula, competence, character, and convictions. But I'm sure there's more to be added to it. Give us a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Ricardo's listening on the World Wide Web, calling from Alpharetta, Georgia. Go ahead, Ricardo.
Hello, Dr. Mohler. Thank you for having me on the show today. Regarding choosing leaders, my daughter, my 17-year-old daughter, asked me the question a couple of days ago in the car on the way to school. And I told her from Scripture, I see that the fear of God is the primary characteristic of one who would serve as a civil magistrate or judge. And I went to Exodus 18 and Deuteronomy 17. And from my viewpoint, I believe is this not just an issue of conviction, but rather a competence issue. Because every time the Scriptures talks about us, the people of God, choosing those people, it's not a, well, I believe, you know, don't choose somebody because he believes something is wrong. It is, if this man does not fear God, if he does not have, if he's not one who hates bribes, et cetera, then that is a competence issue. If he does not qualify there, then he's not worthy of my vote.
Yeah, you know, Ricardo, I want to affirm what you're saying here in terms of being a God-fearer, fearing God in that sense. Of course, the Bible tells us that the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. So, obviously, there's something that's really important there. But, you know, I also think of Luke chapter 18, the parable Jesus told. It's usually labeled the parable of the persistent widow. And you'll remember there's a judge that's described there, and you'll remember the setup of the parable is that this is a woman who keeps going to this judge and gives him no relief until she gets what she wants, which is justice. And Jesus described the judge as one who fears neither God nor man. That was described as wickedness. And, you know, I think you're making a very legitimate point, Ricardo, and I really appreciate the fact that you were ready to give an answer to a 17-year-old daughter. I'm just, first of all, there's just so much good in that, the conversation you just had with her, and the fact that you went to the Scripture, that's just really encouraging. Now, I would say the hard thing to address to the point you made, and I'm affirming your point, the hard thing to be addressed there is what do you do when you might be faced with a situation in which neither candidate appears to be a God-fearer in that sense, to have no fear of God. And that means no respect for the fact that that there is a supernatural authority, that indeed there we are finite and infallible and must have help from on high. That's a very interesting question. I think we'll have to come up with how to answer that as well. Ricardo, thanks so much for your call. And let me just remind you that this week and next, the first two on-air callers to the Albert Mohler Program receive a copy of my new book, Culture Shift, Engaging Current Issues with Timeless Truth, available from Multnomah Press and your local bookstore. Let's go to Steve calling from Fern Creek, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Steve.
Hey, Dr. Mohler, I love your show. Look forward to it all the time. You know, you were asking what do we tell our kids. I think we tell our kids that we look for a candidate that that has the most in common with our own Christian beliefs. And, you know, it doesn't matter if they're a Democrat or Republican, although I believe that usually Republicans line up with our way of, you know, our worldview more than the Dems do. But, you know, that, and if none of them do, that, you know, maybe like McCain and Hillary, you know, maybe we just stay home and don't vote for either of them if they don't represent what we stand for.
You know, we're going to have a lot of thinking to do, Steve. Your call really reminds me of that. Thank you so much for your kind comments. We're going to have a lot of thinking to do as this particular race unfolds. And you're pointing to the category I called conviction, the policies, and you're exactly right. We've got to look. In fact, we've got to interrogate where the candidates are on the policies. And then we have to admit that every one of us has a hierarchy of prioritized policies that are more important to us than others. You know, if someone I think is right on the abortion and marriage questions, but wrong perhaps on a taxation question, you know, I'm going to favor the most important issue rather than the less important issue. All issues are important. They're just not all equally important. A lot to think about as we look forward to this race and, well, the questions we're going to have to answer to ourselves and to others. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We're talking about our Christian responsibility to vote. And as I told a reporter earlier today, you know, that's a part of rendering unto Caesar what is Caesar's. When you have the opportunity to vote, the franchise, voting and not voting are both political decisions. I think a part of what we owe each other and this government and thus our service to God as citizens is to fulfill our responsibility to vote and our responsibility to vote responsibly. That means for Christians voting like Christians. And no one ought to pretend that that's easy to figure out how it is that we are to vote in a way that would truly reflect our Christian commitments. I mean, in some elections, it can be easy. But in many cases, you really have to think. Well, this is the place for thinking Christians. Let's go to the phone calls. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. From Farmington, New Mexico, Donna is listening on KPCL. Go ahead, Donna.
Oh, hi, Dr. Mueller. Yes, I wanted to say that the most important issue for me is whether a candidate is pro-life. And I probably would not vote for anyone who supported abortion.
Donna, thanks for your call. I'm with you 100%. And this means that in order to be intellectually honest, what we're saying is exactly what you said. There are other issues. We know that the other issues are important. But there is a prioritized set of issues for every single voter. There is a hierarchy of issues. And certainly I have to put the dignity and sanctity of every single human life right there at the very top of that list. And I think for good and justifiable reasons. And I'm with you, Donna. And I hope that that evangelical Christians are thinking that way as well. Let's go to Atlanta, Georgia, where Amy's listening on XM 170. Go ahead, Amy.
Yes, I just wanted to say that I just really feel that it's our responsibility as Christians to vote. And even though ultimately if we don't agree with certain things that our party's candidate has chosen, it's our responsibility because they change the course of the history and our world for our country. So I just think it's important for all of us to get out and vote and not stay home because we don't like who our candidate is.
You know, Amy, I want to amplify on what you said here because we need to remember that in the American system of government, not voting is a vote because you have a total number of possible votes that legally could be cast. That's the electorate. The people who do vote obviously have a vote. The people who do not vote actually also contribute to the winning edge of whoever does vote. That's just pure math. A lot of Americans don't think that way. And so we become responsible for voting or for not voting. Amy raises another issue. I hear people say, well, I'm just going to sit this one out because I'm not satisfied with any of the candidates. Well, I'm not sure exactly what some people mean by that, but let me just take it at face value and say there could be a situation. And I'm going to go back to the fact that, again, I said I agreed with Donna, and I really do, that I could not vote for a pro-abortion candidate. Well, let's say that the person at the top of the ticket on both parties is pro-abortion. What do I have to do? I got to vote for someone else. Well, the other person may not have much hope of being elected, but you can write in a candidate. You can vote for a third party candidate. Those are really message votes. Let's face it. We're not expecting the person to get elected, but we are saying I care enough to vote. I feel the responsibility to vote, but I have to make a statement with this vote that indicates my absolute lack of ability to vote for either of these two candidates. They are unsatisfactory and do not deserve my vote. Amy, I really appreciate your point that we need to vote, and I am frustrated by people who say, I'm just not interested enough. I don't think there's anything in the candidates out there that really draws me to them, as if this is a popularity contest. Or people who say, you know, I'm not into that. Hey, you know what? If you are a citizen of the United States, you better be into that. But more importantly, if we're Christians, we have to be into that in terms of our thinking of what it means to be a responsible Christian citizen. We are, as the Apostle Paul makes very clear, first of all, citizens of a heavenly kingdom. In the most important of our citizenships, we don't get a vote. We're not electing God. He is God. He's not up for a vote. He's not up for a referendum. In the kingdom of God, all that you'll find before the throne of God are those who worship him, those who sing his praises and adore him. And thus, we as Christians look forward to that day when men and women from every tongue and tribe and people and nation will be before the throne of God. In that kingdom, we're not going to have to be making these choices. In our earthly kingdom, we do make these choices. And the earthly kingdom is, as we know now, a fallen kingdom. We know that people do not always seek what is right. They often seek what is wrong. We know that the tendency of the society, given sin, is not towards order, but towards disorder. We know that the tendency of society in a fallen state is not toward justice, but injustice. That's why we need government. Government's one of God's gifts to us. We should be very, very thankful that when we wake up in the morning and when we put our heads on our pillow at night, there is a structure of order and responsibility in this culture that restrains evil, that works for the common good. Doesn't mean that it does so perfectly. In fact, it's very imperfect, but at least it's there. It's better to have roads than not to have them. It's better to have traffic lights that work than not to have them. That's just a small symbol of what it means to have that kind of structure and order. All that is to say that we in this particular generation have a responsibility that many others, well, most others in human history have not had. And that is to have a say in who will be the king over us. To say who we would prefer and lend our support to as a candidate for office. Most people have awakened in the morning and gone to sleep at night with a king they didn't vote for, with a despot, a Caesar, an emperor over which they had no choosing, a tribal chieftain, or some kind of inherited and despotic ruler, you name it. Most human beings have not had the opportunity for the stewardship that is ours. They haven't had this responsibility. They haven't had this opportunity. We as Christians have to understand that all of our questions, all of our issues, all of our choices are accountable to the gospel of Jesus Christ, and that means to the lordship of Christ, to the Christian worldview as revealed in Scripture, and to the ultimate end of all things in the glory of God. You know, that really does transform the question, doesn't it? So I hope, in one sense, the first thing that we answer when someone, our child, our neighbor, anyone asks us, for whom do you vote? I hope at least our first thought is, I want to vote in a way that will bring God greatest glory. In this fallen world, well, there's no ticket that automatically promises that. There's no party that can claim that. We've got to think as Christians and figure this out and do our very best in this fallen world to make responsible decisions. We have to be very, very limited in what we expect of government from the first place. But what God assigns to government, we should expect of government. I'm suggesting that we vote for those who demonstrate competence and character and the right convictions, and then we pray for them once someone has been elected to office. Hold them accountable. Back to Final Thoughts in just a moment. I'm Albert Moeller. I don't know what you're going to be doing with your family tonight, but if you have just a few minutes, it's worth it to do a little worldview analysis listening to any of the major debates. And, of course, there's a lot going on, a lot of talking heads and all the rest. But the debate tonight among the Democratic candidates is going to be interesting. And what makes this one particularly interesting is that it is the first standalone debate now that John Edwards has pulled out of the race between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. And for that reason, that kind of head-to-head issue is going to make it very, very interesting. Of course, worldview analysis is what we're called to. So one of the things I'd encourage you to do is talk about it with your kids, talk about it with your spouse, talk about it with your friends and neighbors. You know, what were they actually saying? What does that mean? How does this point connect with another point? Did the person actually answer the question? Was the answer to the question coherent, rational? Did it make sense? Is that a realistic policy? fascinating stuff. And even where there's great difference between the two parties, within the parties, there's a debate to be had. I want to tell you some of the things we'll be talking about in coming days and next week. There are some big things going on, of course, Super Tuesday, but we're going to be talking about some different things on this program. For instance, a report coming out that American homes are now being built almost universally without dining rooms. In other words, eating together in any kind of formal sense is now just disappearing. Instead, what is being found in many homes are entertainment centers and what some home architects are now calling grazing space. Now, that tells you a whole lot about perhaps how American life has changed and how family has been re-envisioned when you go from the dining room to grazing space. I think there's something to talk about there. We're also going to be talking about a Christian understanding of the economic order. That sounds really big, doesn't it? Sounds like a course in graduate school. Well, let's just think about it this way. You got a dollar in your hand? How are you going to spend it? What does a Christian do with a dollar? You know, right now, there are an awful lot of things in this political cycle being debated in economics. Tax policies, a stimulus plan for the economy, investments, stocks, bonds, and all the rest. We were talking earlier this week about greenwashing and, you know, what it means to say that that you are a green business, what it means to talk about free trade coffee and fair trade bananas. I think it's good that we have the opportunity to talk about how we as Christians should engage the market. And just remember, in a totally free market, well, you can sell just about anything. That market doesn't exist. But in the market capitalism, the consumer capitalism that we know in this country, boy, there is an awful lot to talk about in terms of our Christian responsibility. We'll turn to those issues, and on Ask Anything Wednesday, of course, we'll talk about what's on your mind, and we know, whatever the case, there'll be plenty for us to think about and talk about. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. Thanks for joining us today on the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.